Well, good morning, and it's this is the wonderful, the customary dark suits, gentlemen, a few ladies. Lovely to be here. I finally found where my wife's sitting, Valerie. Hi, out there. And I'm ready to talk for a few minutes, but I understand that my task is to hurry up and finish so we can all discuss the problems of federalism. I have some questions for Gordon. I'm putting them off so we can get to them in our proper order. I'm also going to, I have numbers on paragraphs, so like a philosopher, if you write a philosophy paper, you just put the numbers there, one after the other. It just solves the problem of how to follow the argument. So I'm going to have parts and paragraphs that I'll number. So number one, I'm going to say the federal principle was intended to secure American liberty against the political evils of imperial consolidation on the one hand and lawless anarchy on the other hand. The states exist to preserve liberty by preventing federal consolidation of government, in our case, Republican government, to prevent federal consolidation of Republican government into unitary mass democracy, which is not Republican government. The general government, on the other hand, exists to prevent state aggrandizement that nullifies national authority, provokes civil war, and reduces the country to anarchy. Number two, the criteria and conditions of healthy federal Republican government have been the subject of deep controversy. In part, perhaps even in large part, the existence of slavery in the English colonies in North America and in the free and independent United States of America has been the single most important source of controversy and conflict in American federalism. That's arguable, but I'm going to make the statement and let it be there, the single most important source. Slavery was abolished in the United States as a result of the Civil War. But a congeries of issues related to the race relations of slavery have persisted to complicate the practice of constitutional federalism pretty much all along since the end of the Civil War, but especially in the last 50 or so years. It would take several conferences to go into that question of federalism and slavery and race relations. I'm going to put the question this way, number three, part of the third point I want to make. Was competition between states in the 19th century over economic issues, banks, tariff, and land, and moral issues, slavery in Republican society, indicative of flourishing constitutional federalism? Did the Civil War signify the success of federalism or the failure of federalism? Did the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments confirm and perfect the federal union of the founding, or did those amendments subvert and destroy American federalism? There is disagreement on these matters then and now. Today, however, in the early 21st century. The issue, it seems to me, is whether the cumulative historical effect of war, economic development, political democratization, and cultural demoralization in the 20th century has been to subvert federalism and establish in its place a kind of makeshift and alien government of general jurisdiction, a government which is bureaucratically programmed to rule the American people by inculcating compassionate and servile sensibilities in erstwhile American citizens. The political scientist John Marini has argued that the issue of the 21st century is whether unconstitutional centralized bureaucracy will be legitimized or whether constitutionalism based on the federal principle being the organizing principle of American constitution, or whether constitutionalism will be delegitimized. This is an open question. I will suggest, however, that it is harder than one might suppose to eliminate state power and autonomy as an essential element in the relationship between the whole and the parts of the American nation, or of American nationality, if you want to put it that way. Some historical observations. The Interstate Commerce Act of 1887 and the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 prefigured national regulation of the economy. In the early 20th century, the federal government began to treat the commerce and tax powers as a national police power to legislate for the country as a whole, this national police power being the constitutional equivalent of the state police power to legislate for the health, safety, morals, and welfare of society. The Supreme Court began to uphold exercises of the tax and commerce powers of Congress for social reform purposes, as though there were such a thing as the federal police power. A more systematic expansion of centralized government assumed the form of delegation of legislative power to the executive. Here, the constitutional separation of powers denied legislative authority to the executive branch. Congress circumvented the Constitution by authorizing discretionary rulemaking by executive agencies to implement provisions of general statutes. The legal fiction of non-delegation of legislative power was contrived to justify executive lawmaking. President Wilson pursued a constitutional construction in which the president, released from the details of enforcing the laws, released by the appointment of trained public administration experts, president would be free to direct the development of the nation through rhetorical leadership. There were two constitutional amendments, Ed Meese mentioned them last night, that redounded to the expansion of federal power. The first, the 16th Amendment, giving Congress the authority to tax income from whatever source derived. 17th Amendment, providing for the direct election of senators, eliminating the principal constitutional means by which the states protect their powers and interests. Wilson's progressive national self-determination principle was discredited abroad in the aftermath of World War I. this discredited progressivism at home. And in the 1920s, there was tension between two strands of constitutional precedent. The progressive strand augured increasing government regulation of social and economic life, principally under federal authority, but also under state authority, under progressive auspices in the states. A conservative line of constitutional construction, on the other hand, focused on preserving limitations on government in the interest of personal liberty and economic freedom. In the 1930s, the Depression was used politically to discredit conservative constitutionalism. It was superseded by regulatory welfare statism. The New Deal administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt claimed constitutional legitimacy when the Supreme Court in 1937 affirmed federal regulation of industrial production and private property rights. Academic apologists describe the constitutional revolution of the 1930s as the repudiation of dual federalism and the inauguration of cooperative federalism. The principal grounds of constitutional justification for this cooperative federalism were federal preemption of state and local authority by delegation of legislative power to the executive, and also national regulation under the Commerce Clause and the taxing and spending powers of Congress. In the New Deal period, a permanent bureaucracy was established in the federal and state governments that taxed, spent, and consumed an increasing percentage of the nation's income. Power was diffused for policy planning, administration, and implementation at several levels. Bureaucrats and economic interest groups formed patron-client relationships in which industry groups supported an agency's request for funding in return for administrative services. This government structure was distinct from, and it contradicted, the forms and practices of representative Republican government, and this contradiction was a contradiction of traditional federal division of sovereignty for the purposes of promoting and protecting, in many ways, the local jurisdictions against the aggrandizement of the central government. Congressional opposition to Roosevelt's Supreme Court packing and executive reorganization plans in 1937 interrupted the development of progressive reform. In World War II, the affirmation of national unity and the economic stimulus of war production to some extent weakened the appeal of progressive reformism. Subsequent to the New Deal, federal administrations confirmed the revolution in federalism, in other words, the cooperative federalism, which it was a kind of counterfeit federalism in the sense that it tried to reduce conflict and it tried them to coordinate the federal and state governments in ways that were not healthy for Republican government. Driven by civil rights and urban violence, Democrats in the post-New Deal era expanded the regulatory welfare state in the Great Society programs of the 1960s. At that time, and since then, the equation of states' rights with racial discrimination was damaging to federalism as a constitutional principle. Republican administrations in the post-New Deal era generally maintained centralized statist programs under Eisenhower, Nixon, and the two Bush presidencies. The Reagan administration was admirably forthright, however, in supporting the federal principle. And in 1994, after winning control of Congress, Republican lawmakers had some success in affirming the reserved powers of the states as a credible alternative to centralized bureaucracy. Since the 1970s, moreover, the Supreme Court has sporadically made gestures toward affirming the powers of the states without cutting back the powers of the federal government. The situation today, it seems to me, in considering the situation today, it is fair to conclude from a historical standpoint that throughout the 20th century, the democratization of politics and society, combined with the development of managerial corporate capitalism, supported the centralization of authority in the federal government. The question is, does this mean that the nature of the federal government has been changed? Has it been undermined and destroyed irreparably so that when people refer to the federal principle, it consists in command and control administrative regulation of society? Going back to Marini's proposition that I cited earlier, his way of putting the issue, that is the central issue now in dispute. Liberals, on the one hand, contend that arguments about the relative powers of the federal and state governments lack intrinsic meaning and are ideological in nature. Conservatives contend that the true meaning of federalism can be recovered and renewed according to the purpose of the Constitution and the intent of its authors. The constitutional problem is that the federal government has become a government of general jurisdiction, which governs by means of arbitrary administrative dictate, either with or without the subsidized cooperation of state governments. The centralized statist regime has been given constitutional affirmation by the federal courts. But how constitutionally legitimate is it? The recent Supreme Court decision in NFIB against Sebelius addresses this question. I will close with on a temperate and reasonable note by quoting Chuck Cooper, writing in the Heritage Guide to the Constitution on the 10th Amendment. Cooper states that the 10th Amendment poses a substantive limit on assumedly granted powers. Even if modern developments permit or require expansion of congressional authority beyond original limits, such expansion cannot extinguish the retained role of the states as limited but independent sovereigns. As long as the states have the power to tax and spend, exercising legislative, executive, and judicial authority as governments of complete jurisdiction under the state police power, political controversy will persist over the relative powers of the federal and state governments. Government sovereignty will be divided in order to promote the traditional concerns of the federal principle: diffusion of power, local diversity, liberty, and efficiency. Thank you.